Months in the making, it's decision time for President Obama.
I will be making an announcement to the American people about how we intend to move forward.
The commander-in-chief will disclose a strategy early next week, name a count of troops, and outline, perhaps for the first time, an end game in Afghanistan.
After 8 years, some of those years in which we did not have, I think, either the resources or the strategy to get the job done, it is my intention to finish the job.
Defining the job and when it is finished, the Pentagon prepares for another surge.
We'll be landing under fire, gentlemen. Men will die.
Standing orders and tall orders on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, November 25th, Thanksgiving Eve. I'm John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien sitting in for Celeste Headlee. Hi, Miles.
Good morning, John. Good to be here. Coming up this hour, New York Senator Charles Schumer will talk about health care, colleague Sheikh Mohammed, and more. And you know the FDIC. They're supposed to protect your money in the bank. Well, they're overdrawn by a lot, and we'll tell you why. And shopping time for Thanksgiving groceries. You may be headed that way today. Well, where should you be splurging and where should you be getting a discount? We'll give you a good set of advice for shopping for Thanksgiving.
But first, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, joins us on this issue of finishing the job. David, could we be seeing an attempt by President Obama next week to really lay out a coherent endgame in Afghanistan for the first time?
Well, you know, John, I think you heard it in his phrase, finish the job, which, you know, had an echo, although I don't know if he intended it, of the Winston Churchill BBC address in 1941. You guys had the show on then, right?
Yeah.
Which was, give us the tools and let us finish the job. But this is going to be a tough one to do because he's got to explain why we're going in so that we can leave.
Well, I guess the American people will be hungry to hear about an endgame in Afghanistan next week. David Sanger, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning. Our partner, The New York Times, says President Obama is signaling to allies he will increase the number of U.S. troops substantially in Afghanistan. More on that in a moment with David Sanger. But it was a night of pomp and ceremony and fine dining at the White House last night. President Obama capped an effort to improve relations with India with a lavish state dinner for the Indian Prime Minister, his first as president. Meanwhile, we're getting reports this hour that seven Pakistani suspects in last year's terror attacks in Mumbai have been indicted on murder charges. All the men pleaded not guilty. They're accused of helping to plan the attacks, and the first anniversary of those bloody attacks is tomorrow.
The health care battle will begin on the Senate floor next week. The main flashpoint continues to be the so-called public option. Earlier this morning, New York Senator Charles Schumer told us he is fully behind a public option. He said his focus is on the strength of the public option.
Will this new public option, and I think we will have one in the bill, be strong enough to compete head-to-head with the big insurance companies? And if you can say yes to that, we've succeeded, and I'm very hopeful we will be able to say yes to that at the end of the day.
Senator Schumer also talked to us about the job situation. He said once a health care bill is signed, Congress will focus on jobs and the economy like a laser, his words. He does not think there will be another stimulus package, however. It's the busiest day of the travel year. Traditionally, the number of people taking a plane, train, or automobile plummeted 25% last year. The AAA expecting similar numbers this year. Still, the planes will be stuffed all over the country. And be careful with the carry-on baggage, as always. And as this frustrated traveler in Chicago says,
I was unpleasantly shocked at the cost of how much it costs to check my bags.
Yeah, the nickel and dime me to death. AAA estimates 33 million people will travel by car.
Checking markets today. It's going to be a down market in terms of volume, but light trading when the Dow opens at 10,400. The S&P will open slightly above 1,100, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,169. In honor of Thanksgiving, we've opened the lines of the Takeaway Turkey Hotline to help you start your day in the kitchen. Stories, suggestions, advice, we'll give it all to you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Miles O'Brien. Once again, Celeste Headlee is home recovering from a terrible case of laryngitis.
Yes, I guess on this Thanksgiving Eve, I'm kind of like a leftover guest host, right?
We're glad to have you. But let's get right to the top story this morning. The president yesterday stepped into a gaggle of reporters and announced that next week the decision is to be announced on the strategy in Afghanistan. The discussion is finished. And here was part of what he had to say.
After 8 years, some of those years in which we did not have, I think, either the resources or the strategy to get the job done, it is my intention to finish the job.
A clear intention there from the commander-in-chief, but what is the job and what does it mean to actually finish it? Joining us once again, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner in the New York Times. He's also the author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and The Challenges to American Power. We've also assembled a bit of a panel here to take a look from a kind of roundtable perspective what we think is going on in Afghanistan, what an endgame might actually look like. Charlie Sennett is with us, a friend of The Takeaway, executive editor and founder of GlobalPost.com, on the line from Boston. Good morning, Charlie.
Morning, John.
And Nadir Attash, a former Afghan government official and author of Turbulence, The Tumultuous Journey of One Man's Quest for Change in Afghanistan. He joins us from Virginia. Nadir, good morning.
Good morning.
So, David, let me begin with you. First of all, the number that seems to be circulating of troops that Obama will be sending in addition to the troops that are already there is on the order of 30 to 34,000. Can you confirm that, or does that jive with what you're hearing?
Well, close. What we put in this morning's paper is 25,000 to 30,000. Now, partly this is, I think, an effort to make the first digit a two, you know, like those ads.
Right.
This is only $29.95.
Right.
So I think you'll see it close to the 30 number. A point I made in this morning's Times as well is you can do these numbers, John, any way you want to do them. For example, if you announce combat troops, that leaves you open to add in additional support troops or trainers, most of whom are combat troops anyway, later on. And, of course, the president will likely be saying that he's going to reassess this in the summer. So there'll be some room to move the numbers at that time as well. Just as a caution, early in the year when he added troops, early in his presidency, he said 17. It ended up 17,000. He's ended up being 21,000.
Interesting. It's David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Nadir Attash, how are the Afghan people likely to view an outline of an end game by Barack Obama next week, if that's what he indeed spends much of his time doing in his speech?
I think this announcement, of course, this is an advanced announcement without fully benefiting from the details, but this early announcement I don't think will be well received by the Afghan people, because I think what we may have done is turn this war of necessity into a perpetual and open-ended war, finishing the job. I think that really is bothersome. Especially it may de-incentivize President Karzai's reform agenda, because he will have no incentive to really work hard on the reform agenda that he was not willing and wholehearted to begin with. And also, I think that I don't think that the views of Afghans have been properly portrayed in this decision-making process.
All right, interesting. Charlie Sennett, executive editor and founder of GlobalPost.com, you heard Nadir Attash there saying that the Afghan people aren't likely to view a finish-the-job speech with high regard. But how do you incentivize the Hamid Karzai government to deliver what you need to deliver and talk seriously about an endgame in a speech next week? It's kind of a risk, wouldn't you say?
I think it's a huge risk. I mean, how you incentivize the Karzai government is one of these big looming questions. But I think the even harder one is, how are you going to sell this to the American public? David said they've kind of done some alchemy with the price tag, maybe by putting it at 29,000 instead of 30,000. But you have to do an incredible job selling this if it's going to succeed. And if the president gives the address as is expected on Tuesday, it's going to have to be part resolve, part exit strategy, part regional balance. It's a really tough sell, I think, and fateful and consequential, and I think it's the most fateful decision he's made in foreign policy in his presidency, and I think it's very much fraught with peril.
David Sanger, you mentioned Winston Churchill's speech back in the 40s where he suggested, give us the tools, we'll finish the job. Let's put this in some historical context. During the Bush years, it was all about not signaling to the enemy deadlines and timetables. We're not going to say what the end game is. What precedent is there in American history of literally outlining some sort of, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and then it's going to be done?
Well, you know, it would be a wonderful thing to be able to do if you weren't so reliant on partners. But in this particular case, we have two major partners, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And while the Obama administration is new to trying to coax these along, some of us spent 8 years watching a previous administration try to do this, and there are a few lessons from that. The first is, I think the point about incentives to Karzai is very critical, because the U.S. has already said this is only going to work if Karzai cleans up his act, ends corruption, and actually works hard to train an Afghan army. The words I'm looking for next week are the "and then what" words, which is, if Karzai doesn't do any of that, what are we going to do? Pull the troops out? Well, you know, the U.S. government's position has been that the troops are there for American security, that not that they are there for Afghan security. Hmm. And similar problem with the Pakistanis. The Pakistani government has said that it would go after the Taliban and al-Qaeda, but so far the Taliban and al-Qaeda that they've gone after are the ones that are threatening the Pakistani government, not the one that's operating in Afghanistan.
All right, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much. We're going to finish up here now with Nadir Attash, former Afghan government official. Nadir, do you expect the president to speak about possibly working in a counterinsurgency way with the Taliban in addition to the Karzai government, possibly trying to turn people on the ground in local villages?
I don't think that that strategy would be fruitful if we do not have a competent Afghan partner whereby all the Afghans rally behind that government. And I think this announcement works against that objective, and Karzai would not have high incentive to ensure that he has a competent and corrupt-free government so that the people can rally around that government.
All right, a great point. Nadir Attash is a former Afghan government official. Final thought from Charlie Sennett, executive editor and founder of Global Post. Just a few seconds, Charlie. What do you think? Working with the government and the Taliban, or it'll be just talking about the Afghan government?
I think he's going to have to find a way to work with the Taliban and go toward what he originally talked about, which is finding the reconcilables among the Taliban to bring them into the fold. This is an incredibly hard job he has ahead of him. Tuesday is going to be a very tough sell to a very skeptical worldwide audience.
And we'll all be listening. Charlie Sennett, executive editor and founder of GlobalPost.com. Now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's get a look at some of the headlines we're following.
President Barack Obama says the U.S. partnership with India will, we quote him now, be one of the defining partnerships of the 21st century. The president toasted Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh at a lavish state dinner last night at the White House. Prime Minister Singh returned the compliment, raising his glass to the U.S.
The friendly people of the United States of America, and stronger friendship between India and the United States of America.
Last night's event was the first state dinner held by President Obama since he entered the White House. A community activist for the Somali community in America says the FBI investigation in Minnesota is making many people anxious. Earlier this week, the FBI announced 8 more indictments against young Somali men. They're charged with helping recruit young men to fight for a militant organization in Somalia. Earlier on The Takeaway, community activist Mohammed Hassan and the Somali community said the Somali community there is worried. Mohammed Hassan is vice chair of the Somali Cause, an umbrella organization of Somali groups.
Coming up, the fund that's supposed to protect our money in the bank is in the red by a whole lot. The New York Times' Louise Story has us more in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
getting takeout on the day before Thanksgiving? Sounds like a good idea, actually. The news never stops, though. Our first takeout comes from Louise Story, business reporter for the New York Times. You predicted this months ago. The FDIC, supposed to be protecting our money, guaranteeing our money, was running out of it. And now we know what the extent of the red ink is. What is it?
So for the first time since 1992, we're in the red. They have a balance of negative $8.2 billion. They just released their third quarter report yesterday. This is the FDIC. They're the ones that if a bank fails, they make sure that consumers get their money back up to a certain limit. That limit is $250,000 right now.
So they're, the overdrawn? They're overdrawn?
They're overdrawn.
They're overdrawn. And to put it in context, just a year ago, the fund had a positive $34 billion. Now, because of all of the banks that have failed, we've had 124 banks fail this year. We're down to negative $8 billion.
Now, the way that the federal government is going to try to recoup this loss is to force banks to pay their insurance premiums up front. How much money does that represent?
So they're going to pull in $45 billion, which should cover what they expect they'll need if they're right. And they're going to pull it in from the banks by having them prepay what they would have paid through 2012. It's kind of ironic because if you think about it, a year ago, we had the government bailing out the banks. And now we have these
banks
lending money to the FDIC.
Quickly, does it hurt the banks to actually pony up this money for the FDIC? If any bank lost its FDIC coverage, it would fail, right?
Right. This is fine for the banks because of a certain accounting treatment allows them not to have to really count this money they're paying ahead in a way that hurts them. So the accounting treatment lets them off. The money will let the FDIC off. And hopefully the FDIC will let all these troubled banks fail smoothly so we won't lose our money.
It's an economic indicator, but we shouldn't be worried. The FDIC is overdrawn. Louise Story, business reporter for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
To the future that beckons all of us, let us answer its call and let our two great nations realize all the triumphs and achievements that await us. Cheers.
You're here. President Barack Obama serving up a healthy portion of platitudes at the first state dinner of his presidency last night in honor of the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. No meat on the menu. Green curry prawns, naan, pumpkin pie.
Yum.
The entertainment. Jennifer Hudson was the headliner. Others there. Not a bad dinner.
No.
So we hear.
In a big tent there at the White House.
Big tent. 400 people are there. Vishakha Desai was one of the lucky guests. She is president of the Asia Society. She joins us this morning on her way back home. Vishakha, good to have you with us. Thanks for being there. What was the highlight for you?
Well, I think everything from food to entertainment to just the level of people who were there, very unusual group of people from young activists to bold-faced names, very exciting night.
All right. I assume this is your first state dinner?
No.
Oh.
This is my third state dinner.
Oh, nice.
This is old hat for you.
Nice.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Now, what about, you know, I've heard this stuff about, you know, the menu selection. There's a lot of time obviously spent on this. And I've read that they try to steer clear of serving the cuisine of the country that is honored. And in this case, however, there was naan and there was green curried prawns. Did that go over well?
I think it went really, really well because the food was excellent. And I think the reason why it went so well is that it was very much a part of, I think, what this presidency is all about, which is to really be globally sensitive and aware, but also have a unique flavor that is very uniquely American. So that while there were some things that were touches, you wouldn't say it was an Indian meal by any stretch of the imagination. Similarly with music, with National Symphony Orchestra on the one hand, A.R. Rahman of Slumdog Millionaire on the other, and Jennifer Hudson, and a musician from Chicago, you really had a sense that this administration is very focused on making sure it's sensitive, but it's uniquely American.
And speaking of uniquely American, the reporting of this was kind of interesting. You know, it was breaking news on Michelle Obama's dinner attire, and she was strapless, as I understand it. What was your impression of how the First Lady looked?
She looked gorgeous. She looked absolutely dead gorgeous because I think that, first of all, she carries off these dresses so beautifully well. And the dress was made by a designer who really spent 3 weeks in India to get it all hand-stitched with the right kind of sequence. And yet he's an American designer based in America, Naim Khan. So again, it's that idea of an Indian-American nodding to India, but a properly Western dress, which I think was made in India, but for the American audience, for the American First Lady, in an American style.
All right.
Which is very exciting.
Thank you very much, Vishakha Desai, our state dinner reporter here.
Atmospherics, symbolic, but also meaningful there.
She did a good
job. She said, indeed.
Thank you.
So, too much information at work. That was the takeout from you responding to contributor Beth Kobliner yesterday, who was talking all about the dangers of private info going public on the job.
The bottom line is nothing is private. You have to realize no matter what you tell your coworkers, your boss, it's going to get out there. Keep it positive and keep it on business.
Now, Jonathan emailed us to say this is an example of how modern workplaces and traditional privacy don't mix. He writes, why do we put up with our workplaces invading our privacy in the most intimate ways? What Beth said is probably true, but the implication is that employment is complete suppression of our personality, the inability to form human relations with coworkers, because to do so is to risk one's livelihood.
Work as a suppression of personality. Not in radio, though. No. Exactly. Barry gave us his own cautionary tale in his email. He wrote, I worked at a large government office back in the 1980s when I happened to mention to a coworker that my family was active in the Jewish socialist labor movement. From that time, I became known as a communist, and it made life difficult for me, and ultimately, I believe, played a role in ending my career at that office. Well, you can tell us as much as you like. We won't brand you in any way or end your career. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, Todd Zwillick will give us an update on health care and the issue of jobs on Capitol Hill. And also, we're going to be joined by Senator Chuck Schumer. We'll talk about all that and more coming up in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes past the hour. News out of Pakistan this morning. 7 men have been charged in last year's terror attacks in Mumbai. The first indictment in a case being watched closely by India and the U.S. to see if Pakistan makes good on promises to bring those responsible for the Mumbai attacks a year ago to justice. Meanwhile, President Obama says Americans will support more fighting in Afghanistan once they understand what's at stake.
It is in our strategic interest, in our national security interest, to make sure that Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies cannot operate effectively in those areas. We are going to dismantle and degrade their capabilities and ultimately dismantle and destroy their networks.
The president is expected to lay out the new war strategy during a primetime address next week. Today is the busiest travel day of the year. AAA says nearly 40 million Americans, most of them will travel 50 miles or more away from home.
Also on the move today, an estimated 3 million Muslims are in Mecca to perform the Hajj, the annual holy pilgrimage to the city of Medina. They're getting soaked in rare thunderstorms right now, and Saudi authorities are warning pilgrims to move carefully in the flooded streets. Here's something unusual. An airline fined for stranding passengers. The Department of Transportation hit Continental Airlines and ExpressJet Airlines with a $100,000 fine for stranding passengers for nearly 6 hours this summer. Link Christian is one of the stranded passengers. He's happy to hear it.
The amount of the fines is not as critical as the fact that they were fined.
The flight was rerouted during a storm, landed in Rochester, Minnesota, but passengers were forced to stay aboard until the weather cleared. And even in a bad economy, toys are one thing parents don't seem to skimp on. So what's shaping up to be the hot toy this Christmas, you ask? Well, retailers say the big seller so far this year are Zuzu Pets, toy hamsters, and they're flying off the shelves. John, listen up. Just like the Cabbage Patch Kids a couple generations ago, starting to feel old, and then Tickle Me Elmo's more recently.
Toy hamsters are an upgrade on the real hamsters, I have to say.
Yeah, they don't smell, they don't need food, perfect, and they don't wake you up at night. Anyway, those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
All right, we're going to be joined in a moment by Senator Charles Schumer, the senior senator from the state of New York. But Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, joins us now. Todd, give us an update. As the debate begins on health care reform in earnest next week in the Senate, are senators like Charles Schumer defensive on the issue of where the public option is going to go?
I don't know about defensive, John, but certainly Charles Schumer has said he wants a strong public option. He says it over and over, and he's one of the strongest sort of defenders of the policy in the Democratic caucus, and there's a real reason for that. You know, Senator Schumer traditionally represents maybe the left part of the Democratic Party, and we've said over and over there are at least four Democrats who have said in one form of language or another that they're not supporting a public option coming off the floor. So he needs to negotiate with them. He's a point person for Harry Reid, for the majority leader, on how to get these senators, if he can get four of them, maybe you can only get three plus Olympia Snow, how to get them on board with either something that is a weaker public option that you can sell or something that has another name that you don't have to call public because people don't want big government.
We'll ask him about it quickly. You know, Louise Story was talking this morning that jobs has been described by some lawmakers as possibly President Obama's Katrina in the debate over financial regulatory reform. Is that what you're hearing?
Democrats know this. If job numbers don't improve by the next election, they know it is going to be terrible for them. You're going to see Barack Obama holding a job summit early next month, probably right after the Afghanistan announcement. And Democrats have already said they're formulating what they're calling a jobs bill that they want to pass before Christmas. Not a stimulus, but a jobs bill.
All right, Todd, hold on there. We're now joined by the senior senator from the state of New York, Charles Schumer. Senator, we're just talking with Todd Zwillick there. Can you confirm that jobs are possibly increasingly becoming an issue in Washington for the president?
I think jobs, after, you know, we finish health care and, God willing, the president signs a good bill, I think we will focus like a laser on jobs and the economy. I think that's what the public wants us to do. I think that's really the next item on the agenda because this, you know, I think the deck that the president was handed, the deck of cards, was an awful one. The economy was in the worst recession since World War II. And the usual tools to get out of a recession, which has been lowering interest rates, which has worked time and time again, were unavailable because the same deck had zero. He was handed an economy where the interest rates were 0%.
Already at zero. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. You make a good point.
He was given a difficult situation. I mean, I think he avoided something that was a very real possibility, which is we could have gone into a depression or what the economists call a deflationary spiral where prices get lower. People get laid off and prices get lower still because there's less buying power. No one knows how to get out of that. So with the stimulus, with its imperfections, that was avoided. And now the economy is sort of beginning to turn around, but it's coming out of a deep hole. Its turnaround is slower because we don't have the tool of interest rates. And I think history will look back and say they did a good job. But obviously, if you're looking for work, that's not much consolation. So we're going to have to do more. But I doubt we're going to have a large, large second stimulus, given the deficit problem.
Okay, well, that's a news story coming from you as one of the members of the leadership in the Senate. Let's talk about health care for a moment.
I just want to finish. Go ahead. We will focus on areas that need help, creating jobs, getting small business lending, and still focusing on the housing markets.
All right, moving to health care, how worried are you that the health care bill that comes out of the Congress will be too much of a compromise based on the kinds of things that you have advocated for your entire legislative career?
Well, it's always a worry. Obviously, to do the major heavy lift that doing a health care bill entails and then not have it do the job would be a big mistake. So far, I think Senator Reid's bill, the bill he's put together, combining, I think, the best of the Finance Committee and Health Committee, is a very, very good bill. And I think that with one or two exceptions, that will end up being what we end up doing, more or less. The two issues that would probably be most outstanding are public option, where I feel very strongly we should have a good, strong public option in the bill, and abortion, where I'm very hopeful that the Senate language, which keeps basically the status quo, which for those of us who are pro-choice, the status quo is not a great thing, but we realize that this should not be an abortion bill. This should be a health care bill. The attempt to move it away from the status quo is troubling, but I'm hopeful that we can succeed in bringing it back to where the Senate bill is.
Senator Schumer, does no public option mean no vote for the bill from Chuck Schumer?
Well, you know, you never draw lines in the sand, but I don't think we'll be in that place. I think the House is strongly for a good public option. It's not the public option that some people wanted. It does not set rates related to Medicare. It negotiates rates. It's called a level playing field public option, which means once it's set up by the government, it has to compete on its own with the insurance companies. But that's the key. You need something strong enough to compete with the insurance industry. The insurance industry is highly concentrated. They don't compete on the basis of cost. It's one of the main reasons that costs keep going up and up and up. And the benchmark will be, is this, to me anyway, and I think to most of my colleagues who believe in the public option, will this new public option, and I think we will have one in the bill, be strong enough to compete head-to-head with the big insurance companies? And if you can say yes to that, we've succeeded, and I'm very hopeful we will be able to say yes to that at the end of the day.
Well, we've got to go. Thank you so much, Senator. I mean, we'll take that as news. He believes there will be a public option in the final bill on health care reform. New York Senator Chuck Schumer, thanks so much for being with us. Coming up, Thanksgiving grocery shopping on a discount, where to splurge and where not to. Melissa Clark, later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee. 10 years ago today, off the coast of South Florida, some fishermen found a 5-year-old boy floating in the Atlantic. His name? Elian Gonzalez. His mother had drowned as they tried to flee Cuba on a small aluminum boat. The debate over whether he should stay with relatives in the U.S. or be sent back to his father in Cuba quickly took on a life of its own.
Taking consideration of the mother's risk and that she lost her life to make her son free.
The love and emotional support that this child needs is with his father.
Children be better off with their parents? Almost always, but not always.
That's President Clinton there at the end. The saga ratcheted up tension between the United States and Cuba. So on this morning, a status check. Elian is about to turn 16. Fidel Castro is no longer El Presidente, and there is a new administration in Washington. So how are U.S.-Cuba relations now, and how are things in Cuba? And Louise Bardock is author of Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, and previously of Cuba Confidential. And good to have you with us this morning.
My pleasure.
So give us an update on Elian. How is he doing?
Elian is just fine. His family has been moved into, you could say, a considerably more commodious home in Cardenas, which is where he was from. They had a quite a nice home to begin with, but by Cuban standards, they have a very terrific home now. The government explained that that was to help them out after one of the hurricanes a few years ago, but many of their neighbors did not get the same upgrade. His father, Juan Miguel Gonzalez, is doing especially well, and he now is a member of the Cuban National Assembly. And in fact, Elian's doing so well that he got a call from Fidel Castro when he was in the hospital, in 2007. That would be 2 birthdays ago, to wish him happy birthday. Mm. So he's been doing quite well and continues to get first-class treatment.
Yeah, first-class to say the least. Obviously, yes. Not any worse for the wear after all that has transpired.
I guess you could say certainly by social and political standards. Of course, you know, he underwent a grueling journey, and he will never have his birth mother again, but he certainly gets privileges in Cuba that are not available to the average Cuban.
All right, let's talk about the difficult U.S.-Cuba relationship. Now that Fidel Castro's brother, Raul, is in charge, how have things changed, if at all?
Well, things have changed considerably. We have a new president, which is Raul Castro, but I guess in certain respects, Fidel Castro retains veto power. The relationship with the U.S. has undergone several major changes. During the Bush years, things dramatically contracted, and there was virtually no travel, no contact with the average American, and now all that is starting to change. Slowly, piecemeal, by the Obama administration. And what we will probably see in the next year or so is that we will be back to what we had under the Clinton administration. Plenty of travel, certainly we already have already that for Cuban Americans, but probably for the average American too. We're going to have a lot more travel, a lot more contact. We will continue to open up diplomatically, you know, and postal service.
And Luis Bardach, we got to cut it off. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it. I sure would like to visit Cuba before the Starbucks comes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee, who's trying to get her voice back. And John Hockenberry is here in full voice.
Good morning,
for Thanksgiving. Yeah. Coming up, what's worth splurging on and what should you scrimp on when you go shopping for Thanksgiving? We know many of you will be in the markets later today. We'll give you a grocery thrift list in a few moments. Say that six times fast. But first, a check of the news at about 48 minutes past the hour. Some fresh economic news this hour. Consumer spending rebounded last month, rising 0.7%. That's better than expected. Meanwhile, the weekly claims for jobless benefits have fallen 466,000. That's the lowest level in more than a year. A community activist for the Somali community in America says the FBI investigation in Minnesota is making a lot of people there nervous. Earlier this week, the FBI announced 8 more indictments against young Somali men. They are charged with helping recruit young men to fight for a militant organization in Somalia. On The Takeaway this morning, community activist Muhammad Hassan and the Somali community say they are worried.
It has been a very long investigation and has taken really toll on the community, literally has put the community in siege.
Muhammad Hassan is vice chair of the Somali Cause, an umbrella organization for Somali groups.
The Transportation Department says Toyota will replace gas pedals for almost 4 million U.S. vehicles due to a sudden acceleration of the pedal or the pedal becoming stuck in the floor mat. Toyota will have dealers shorten the length of gas pedals beginning in January. In sports news, Roger Federer has reclaimed his spot at the top of the tennis world. He's number one for the fifth time in his career. The record 15-time Grand Slam champion is now closing in on Pete Sampras's record. An American businessman made a visit to Iraq yesterday, Miles. I don't know if you paid attention to this. Eric Schmidt, Google's CEO, arrived in Baghdad, and it's always a high-profile moment when Eric Schmidt shows up. But he went to the Iraqi National Museum to announce a project with the Iraqi government to preserve the archaeological treasures in that museum. Joining us, Rod Nordland. He was at the news conference that Eric Schmidt held in Baghdad. He's a reporter for our partner, The New York Times, in that city. Good morning, Rod. And how significant was this news conference event? I mean, we all remember the headline of the looting of the Iraqi Museum back in 2003.
Right, and ever since then, the museum has been closed, although they've officially reopened it 3 times. Each time, it was just kind of a ceremonial opening, and it's in fact stayed closed to most of the public ever since. And so the idea of this is they'll be able to, Google will put all these objects up in a virtual form on the internet somewhere, and people will be able to visit the museum without actually going there.
Now,
which is certainly one solution to the violence.
Indeed. And how much of an investment is this on the part of Google? And as you note in your article in the New York Times, there is already a virtual digital space that is supposed to represent the collection of archaeological treasures in Baghdad.
That's right, made by the Italians at a cost of €1 million and went online back in June. The Google folks say theirs will be much more extensive and it'll be a more realistic experience, sort of recreating the idea of walking through the museum. How much it'll cost, it's hard to say, although Google can probably produce most of it in-house. But they're talking about something even more extensive that'll have many thousands of objects that you can see from different angles and so forth.
All right. Rod Nordland, who was at the announcement by Eric Schmidt, Google CEO, who arrived in Baghdad and talked about the development of a virtual site to see the archaeological treasures in the Baghdad Museum digitally and virtually online. Thank you, Rod. All you can eat. Well, I'm going to stuff my face to a funky beat. We're going to walk inside. And guess what's up?
Put the food on my plate. Add some coke in my cup. How's that for Thanksgiving music? It's the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and that means a lot of us will be traveling and then navigating the supermarket aisles. Could be dangerous out there, people. Be careful.
I'm going to be shopping. I'll be shopping today.
Make sure you have a list and check it twice, John. All right? We've asked Takeaway food contributor and friend of the show, Melissa Clark, food writer for The New York Times, to help us get through this relatively unscathed. Reminder
smells
to
good
you.
In the studio. Melissa Clark is here.
We are scooping Butterball this year. The Takeaway Turkey Hotline is open to help you start your day in the kitchen. Send us your questions or your tales of turkey gone awry. My take at thetakeaway.org or 877-8. My take, if you prefer to do it by phone. Melissa, good morning.
You know, Melissa was here last year doing leftovers from the Thanksgiving dinner. Now she's all about the grocery list.
Well, these aren't
leftovers
that was from last year, right?
Yeah, that was after, right? So.
These aren't leftovers from last year. We're eating. Okay. Just want to make sure.
I froze them very well, really. They're going
to
be fine.
First, the list. You go into the market.
Yes.
What, you know, because these are hard times, and this is an expensive meal. Mm-hmm. Where should you be spending the money? Where should you be saving?
Okay, well, the first thing is obviously the most important part of a Thanksgiving meal is the turkey, and that's where you want to spend your dough. Because the better the turkey, the better the entire meal. So you're in the supermarket, you're looking at your options. Probably it's too late for you to get a heritage turkey because you usually have to order those ahead. But if you happen to see something labeled heritage turkey, buy it.
Really? What's that?
That is going to be the best turkey you've ever had.
Oh,
that's
really?
A turkey that's raised outside on the farm like we used to have turkeys raised. It's an old breed of turkey.
It's the blue blood of turkey.
Exactly.
Huh?
And it's raised in this really in a way that gives it a very diverse diet. Its flesh has a lot of flavor. It's going to have. It's not going to be top heavy. It's going to have an even, a lot of dark meat too, if you like dark meat, which I do. And it's going to cook up really juicy with a crisp skin. But you probably can't find it. But if you see it, buy it. Next best choice, organic turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because an organic turkey also it's going to have a very diverse feed. It's going to have eaten a lot of different things. It's probably going to have some outside space too, and it's going to have a very well-developed flavor. Okay, if you can't find organic and you can't find that, then go for kosher. Kosher turkeys.
Really?
Yeah, kosher. Mm. People don't really know this, but for kashrut food law, you have to be also humanely raised. That's part of the koshering law. And it also has had, it's already pre-brined for you because it's been salted. So it has a lot of flavor because of that. So those are your choices.
Heritage, organic, kosher.
Exactly.
And then if you're failing
that, worst comes to worst,
spam,
then we go to,
right?
Yeah, then we go to whatever you can find.
Your point here is it's not simply environmental. You're talking about if you cut corners on the turkey, you are running the risk of dryness in the breast and the whole problem.
You just
problem
don't get
of,
any flavor. Yep, I mean, bland turkey has no flavor. The turkeys that have had a good diet have a better flavor,
right.
So that's important.
And I thought it was because we cook it to an inch of its
life.
Well,
then there's
which is
that.
A,
then
yeah,
don't
there is
oh,
that.
Right, then don't mess it up in the kitchen. Once you've
there
got your expensive
that.
Bird, take yeah. care of it. You want to make sure you want to check it. You want to roast it carefully so that you have nice juicy meat all over. Season it well. Lots of fresh herbs.
Okay, so you put your money down on a good turkey.
Yeah.
Where should you pull back? Where
okay,
should you save?
Well, this is not your meal for your $25 a bottle olive oils for the most part. Because, we're cooking American food. We're cooking foods with a lot of flavor. We're probably using a lot of bacon and spices and herbs. So you want to take your really refined ingredients like very expensive extra virgin olive oil that's been flown in from Italy, mm-hmm. and your balsamic vinegar that's been aged for 20 years. Those things are expensive, and they probably don't belong at your
waste
Thanksgiving dinner.
Waste of time.
Dinner.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. Your El Cheapo vinegar, your El Cheapo oil.
Exactly.
Right?
A little Crisco is fine.
Well, don't
what
use
about,
Crisco. A little lard. Lard is
potatoes?
Cheap. That's good.
What about potatoes?
Well, that's where
fixins,
you, another place you want to spend your money is spend it on the potatoes. Because people, potatoes are cheap anyway. So why don't you just buy the best potatoes you can find? It costs $1.89 instead of 99 cents for potatoes from the farmer's market. If you can get to a farmer's market or from a store, look for something called, for sweet potatoes, you want to find Garnet or Jewel sweet potatoes. These sweet potatoes are bred to be very sweet and delicious. Delicious. Mm. You don't even need the marshmallows.
That's what's right here.
So
we have,
and that's in front of you
we
right
have
now.
The sweet potato dish.
Good.
And those
quite
are good,
excellent.
Right?
And it's frankly, not as sweet, which I like.
Right. Well, this is what we did. We used really sweet potatoes, the garnet yams. But mm-hmm. instead of putting a pineapple and the brown sugar, this has
why
a little,
make them sweeter? You don't need
exactly,
to, right?
Exactly. This, you're going to have the contrast between the sweet and then it has a chili on
excellent.
It.
That's
garlic,
excellent.
Chili, onions. And this is something that if you serve this to your guests, they're going to wake up. They're going to get out of their, stuffing complacency and say, oh, my goodness, this is delicious.
Love the bite.
This
it's
is
nice.
So
it's
good.
Not
nice.
Stuffing complacency.
You know what happens. You eat the stuffing. You eat the turkey. This is going to wake them up again.
Great advice, Melissa. The antidote to tryptophan. Melissa Clark is the food writer for the New York Times, and we thank you for being with us. You can check out Melissa's top 5 prioritizing tips for where to spend your money on your Thanksgiving dinner and her recipe for spicy sweet potato, which we heartily endorse, I believe, this morning.
Heartily endorse.
Unanimous.
Yes,
unanimous.
Red pepper hash and sweet potatoes.
Red pepper hash on our website. Thetakeaway.org is the place to find that.
So Thanksgiving, we can't stop talking about it. We're opening up the lines of the Takeaway Turkey Hotline to help you start your day in the kitchen. And we are serious. We've got the expertise and the hotlines, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Give us your advice. Tell us your problems. We will solve them. Or give us a a story like John, who emailed, "Our dad hosted Thanksgiving a few years back. He was newly single. He was very proud he managed to cook the turkey by himself, although he didn't know about that bag of giblets and left them inside. That bird didn't fare so well. Remember the giblets. Great advice, John." Andrew has this one. "One year, our oven didn't work, so my mother borrowed her sister's oven. My aunt isn't too savvy in the kitchen. She feared leaving the house in case the oven blew up. Kind of silly. Wouldn't you want to be out of the house if the oven blew up? Further on, we got a call from her. The button popped up. The button popped up. We went to pick up our turkey, and it was raw. We proceeded to roast it back home in a broken oven." Call us with your story and questions. The New York Times' Kim Severson and Julia Moskin will join us tomorrow to answer all of them. You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Happy Thanksgiving Eve. This is The Takeaway.
You think you've got too many people to feed for Thanksgiving? Well, try this grocery list on for size.
63,000 pounds of potatoes, 8,700 cans of cranberry sauce, 61,000 pounds of stuffing, and more than 465,000 pounds of turkey. For dessert, there will be 67,000 pies and cakes.
They say an army moves on its stomach, but after all that chow, our troops overseas might wish they were marching toward a nap. We're talking turkey and tryptophan on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. Welcome to The Takeaway, Wednesday, November 25th, Thanksgiving Eve. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee, who's lost her voice. John Hockenberry is here with me, though.
Yes, and we wish Celeste well. Morning, Miles. Coming up, we go to Minnesota for how the Somali-American community is reacting to a terror investigation that was revealed this week. What movies can you see with the family this weekend? There's a whole lot of options. And Faith in America, our series continues with the beginning of the Hajj and the nation's first special representative to Muslim communities.
But first, Specialist Navid Ali Shah joining us from Balad, Iraq. He is serving our country, and we thank him for that. It's good to have you with us, Navid. I'm curious, with the turkey and all the trimmings there, does that make you happy or does that make you homesick?
First of all, it makes me homesick immediately. You know, just thinking about everything that my family is doing at home, you know, we'll definitely want to be there.
All right, Navid, we'll be back with you in just a little bit. We do understand that, and we continue our discussion of turkey and trimmings and Thanksgiving overseas for people in harm's way, so stay with us for that. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
This time next week, we will know President Obama's plans for Afghanistan. Earlier this morning, we spoke to the New York Times' David Sanger, who says the American public should expect a significant surge of troops.
What we put in this morning's paper is 25,000 to 30,000. I think you'll see it close to the 30 number.
At a news conference yesterday, President Obama says there's only one thing that matters to him.
After 8 years, some of those years in which we did not have, I think, either the resources or the strategy to get the job done, it is my intention to finish the job.
The president will lay out the new war strategy during a primetime address on Tuesday. We've also heard this morning that 10 other NATO countries will also be increasing their troop numbers by a total of 5,000. Seven Pakistani suspects in last year's terror attacks in the Indian city of Mumbai have been indicted on murder charges. All of the men pleaded not guilty. They're accused of helping to plan those attacks. The first anniversary of them is tomorrow. New numbers out this morning, economic numbers that is. Weekly claims for jobless benefits plunged to 466,000. That's the lowest level in more than a year. Consumer spending rebounded, meanwhile, last month, rising a better-than-expected 0.7%. And earlier this morning, we asked Senator Charles Schumer of New York, Democrat from New York, how big a priority the economy is for the president.
After, you know, we finish health care and, God willing, the president signs a good bill, I think we will focus like a laser on jobs and the economy.
In his conversation with us, Senator Schumer said, among other things, he doesn't believe there will be another Washington stimulus package.
The Washington Post is closing its last U.S. bureaus outside the D.C. area. The newspaper, which like nearly every other paper in the country is losing money, is shuttering its Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York bureaus at the end of the year. The man who claims to be the godfather of spam has been sentenced to more than 4 years in prison. Prosecutors say Alan Ralsky, who reportedly sent 70 million email messages a day from fake names, was part of a team that sent billions of illegal emails to inflate the price of Chinese penny stocks. Looking abroad, officials say hundreds of icebergs have broken off the Antarctic shelf and are drifting in the South Pacific Ocean toward New Zealand. They pose a risk to ships, and scientists say the increasing rate and size of these bergs appear to be the result of global warming.
Probably drift on Wall Street today when the Dow opens at 10,400. S&P will open slightly above 1,100, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,169. Light pre-holiday trading. We're opening up the lines of the Takeaway Turkey Hotline, 877-8-MY-TAKE, for your questions, your stories, and any advice you might have for Thanksgiving cookers. MyTake at thetakeaway.org is your email address.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee with John Hockenberry. We're talking turkey
morning,
this morning. We are talking
turkey and the troops.
And the troops. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about getting the turkey and all the trimmings to the troops, a big logistical deal. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But there are a lot of troops outside of Iraq and Afghanistan who may not be getting feted as well. As a matter of fact, one of them is joining us on the line right now. First Lieutenant Russell Galletti. He's with an army unit in Grafenwehr, Germany. He's headed to Afghanistan a little later this winter, perhaps part of that surge that's coming up. Lieutenant, good to have you with us, first of all.
Hey, good morning.
Tell us about your Thanksgiving plans.
Well, we've got a lot of Humvee crews that need to go through a motorized gunnery range, so we're going to be working right through the holiday and probably through the whole weekend to get everyone qualified on what they need to do.
So turkey ready to eat kind of thing? Is there such
possibly
a thing?
Yeah. I think they did away with the turkey MRE a couple of years ago, but if we can get some of the good chicken with pasta ones.
Chicken, so that's it, chicken with pasta and an MRE.
Yeah, so Pentagon, you hear that? Galletti, Lieutenant Galletti, his order is for the chicken with pasta MREs. No scrimping here.
Pesto sauce, please, right?
Yeah. Yes, it's a chicken pesto MRE. It's my
favorite.
It is. Favorite.
There you have it. Well, let me ask you this. On Thanksgiving, is it better to be busy and eating an MRE or sitting down to a meal, which is kind of a faux family setting with the turkey and the trimming apps in the family, you know?
I like being busy. I spent one Thanksgiving in basic training years ago and one Thanksgiving in Iraq, and both times I was miserable. So this is there's more than enough work to go around tomorrow, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So
are you going to be miserable?
I'll miss my family and friends.
Are you going to be okay?
Oh, yeah. We got to keep an eye on our soldiers to make sure they're not moping. But it's kind of an advantage because in Germany, I don't think they really celebrate Thanksgiving anyway. And the Hungarians we're assigned with definitely don't. So we're going to pretend like it's not even happening. And we're pretty thankful for the people that are around us and the training we've been getting so far.
Lieutenant, on a serious note, can we possibly run the risk of getting you discharged? Have you received orders for this alleged surge that the president is going to announce next week?
I don't believe my unit is part of the surge. We've been laid on to go for probably almost a year now, and just been in the training pipeline.
All right. Lieutenant Russell Galletti, happy Thanksgiving to you. We thank you for your service. Please pass it along to all the troops who serve under you.
I definitely will. Thank you very much.
All right.
He's going to be deployed to Afghanistan later this winter.
Exactly.
He's been a year in the pipeline, though.
So that shows you how long it takes to get these things ramped up. So the question is, what's for dinner tomorrow in Iraq and Afghanistan? You know what, but let's hear those numbers one more time.
63,000 pounds of potatoes, 8,700 cans of cranberry sauce, 61,000 pounds of stuffing, and more than 465,000 pounds of turkey. For dessert, there will be 67,000 pies and cakes.
Holy tryptophan, Batman. That is a lot of Thanksgiving stuff.
And that's just for the Iraq and Afghanistan?
That's just it.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the Pentagon's Jeff Morrell making the Thanksgiving sort of menu there.
Yeah. I don't think the pilgrims imagined this in 1621.
No,
what do you
think? Not indeed.
Now, a couple of thoughts. Vice President Joe Biden had a Thanksgiving-style feast for military families day before yesterday. Let's listen to him.
The American people appreciate it, but the truth is they don't know it. They don't live it every day. They have no idea, and particularly the sacrifice so many of you have made.
The Biden family will likely have a good holiday. His son, Beau, is back stateside after a long stint in Iraq. Here's Jill Biden.
We're a military family. I'm a military mom. And I remember what it was like on Thanksgiving for our whole family. We pretended like everything was okay, but, you know, our hearts felt heavy.
All right, let's check in with some troops a long way from home. We're joined by Specialist Navid Ali Shah, who is Public Information Officer for the Army, stationed in Balad. Also, Michael Hoffman is with us, served as an intelligence officer in the Air Force. He's currently a staff writer for the Military Times. He joins us from Washington. Navid, you were on just a little while ago, and we were talking about whether you're, you know, get homesick and whether the turkey actually makes it worse in a way. We were just talking to a lieutenant in Germany. They're going to have MREs and be running around in Humvees, and he says that's better. Would you rather be busy and not even thinking about Thanksgiving?
You know, I've been busy before thinking about things and not thinking about Thanksgiving, and I think I would rather be, you know, be able to celebrate the holiday with my, you know, my friends here that I, you know, I'm serving with right now than be busy. I mean, everyone gets has their own choice, and I think I like this way better.
Yeah, Michael Hoffman, a lot of times you'll see high-level politicians drop in on Thanksgiving for the troops. I remember a couple of years ago, famously, President Bush dropped into Iraq. It was, you know, much was made about the whole secrecy surrounding the event. Are we likely to see something like that this Thanksgiving?
Well, I think I know for a fact that the chief of staff of the Air Force, as well, is traveling into Afghanistan to spend time with his airmen. Not sure about the president, but I can confirm that, you know, the General Schwartz will be heading out there to spend time with his troops and share some turkey with them.
Navid, set the scene for us. Where are you right now, and what's it like experiencing? I don't know if you've had the opportunity to experience many holidays over there yet. I don't know how long you've been over there. But what's it like being in that setting and then, you know, putting in a piece of what is so a part of being an American?
Well, right now here in Balad, we got all of the dining facilities have been decked out with holiday decorations, and they're, you know, getting ready for this feast. They're preparing for us, like you said, you know, all these things, turkey, mashed potatoes, and pies, and everything like that. So they're really going to make it a atmosphere where you can really try to, you know, get together with your unit and enjoy that time. You know, just kind of like the way you would when you were home.
Right. And do you get down during the holidays?
We do, definitely. I mean, everyone's here just thinking about their family and thinking about my wife and kids back home. And it's kind of more difficult, but, you know, we try to talk to them, try to communicate with them on Skype or call them, and try to just, you know, get through the holiday as best we can. But
what did we do before the internet and Skype? Michael Hoffman, lots of suicides have come out of the Iraq conflict, and obviously the mental health of the troops is a big issue. Are there enough people watching them to make sure they're getting through the holidays well?
Well, I think a lot of the leadership within the military is really taking this as a very serious problem, as they should. And, you know, it's really about the leadership, your officers, your NCOIC, really just watching his enlisted troops, making sure that they have plenty of time to talk to their family on Skype, as I pointed out, and just maybe even keeping them busy, you know, making sure that you don't have a loner. You have the all the guys coming together within the unit, maybe sharing, like was mentioned before, even if it's a MRE, you know, a special MRE, just making the holiday special and letting them know they're part of the bigger family of the military.
It is a family, isn't it? Michael Hoffman, Navid Ali Shah, and earlier Lieutenant Russell Galletti, thank you all for your time. Thank you all for your service. We wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. And now, about quarter past the hour, here's a look at the rest of the stories we're following.
There's been some positive economic news this morning on the eve of Thanksgiving. Consumer spending rebounded last month, rising by 0.7%. That's better than expected. Meanwhile, the weekly claims for jobless benefits have fallen to 466,000, and that's the lowest level in more than a year. Senate health care bill continues to be debated over in Congress. The formal debate will open next week. Speaking on The Takeaway earlier, the senior senator from New York, Charles Schumer, said he and many of his colleagues have a clear benchmark relating to the public option.
Will this new public option, and I think we will have one in the bill, be strong enough to compete head-to-head with the big insurance companies? And if you can say yes to that, we've succeeded, and I'm very hopeful we will be able to say yes to that at the end of the day.
That was New York Senator Charles Schumer speaking to us earlier this morning.
Overseas, a Pakistani court has charged 7 people in connection with last November's attacks in the Indian city of Mumbai. The attacks killed more than 160 people. All 7 have pleaded not guilty. The first anniversary of those attacks is tomorrow. Coming up on the program, we will talk football with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Will Notre Dame coach Charlie Weiss be looking for a new job soon? I think you know the answer.
Notre Dame vigil there, I think.
Yes, I think it is a vigil. We'll find out in just a few moments.
Hey, you want that to go?
Yes, good morning. And for your pre-Thanksgiving takeout, we've got Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen here. We've got Todd Zwillick down in Washington. We've got Karina Longworth here to talk about movies in just a minute. But first, let's begin with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, John. Good morning.
So the president announced officially that next week we will get this strategy laid out in Afghanistan. But the White House, in coming up to this moment, has been signaling through Robert Gibbs and others that they're concerned about the sort of costs of this war in Afghanistan. And it seems like they're being sensitive to some on Capitol Hill who've been very loud on this subject. What are lawmakers going to say in anticipation of this new strategy in Afghanistan?
Well, House Appropriations Chairman David Obey, who controls the purse strings in the House, ultimately extremely powerful, has already said that continuing to fund two wars would prevent the U.S. from really ever regaining its economic footing. He's extremely concerned about the cost. Frankly, Obey's concerned about just continuing the wars and that Americans are not connected to the war effort in any way, except Americans anyway who don't have sons or daughters in the military. So it's one thing for David Obey to say it, but yesterday the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, acknowledged on a conference call with some economists that many of her Democrats are becoming increasingly uncomfortable as well with the prospect of funding these wars, John, and that they're facing voter anger back home. So the discomfort, you know, has also started to spread to the Senate. There's been some remarks made by senators. So when Barack Obama unveils this strategy next Tuesday, he's going to have a lot of concern on Capitol Hill that he's going to have to deal with, not just in the American public.
Talking to the American people and to lawmakers on Capitol Hill. A pardon for Thanksgiving at the White House on the agenda today?
The national annual turkey pardoning is today, John. This is Barack Obama's first turkey pardoning. Of course, everything that Barack Obama does these days is his first, right? You know, his first. First state dinner, first trip to Asia, first turkey pardoning.
Quickly.
So I did take the liberty of checking into some of the lobbying efforts of the turkey industry. This is Washington, after all, and I thought it'd be good to look at how much money campaigns and candidates are gobbling up from the turkey industry. So look at the National Turkey Federation. They spent $132,000 on campaign contributions in 2008. Butterball, the political action committee, spent $35,000 in Tyson Foods, $200,000
wow.
on elections.
A wet blanket for Thanksgiving from our very own Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
My pleasure.
What a buzzkill. Sorry, I'm just contemplating the Butterball lobby. Right. I guess they must really pack them in. Anyway, on to sports now. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, good to see you.
Good morning.
Tough times in South Bend right now. Charlie Weiss took the reins of Notre Dame football in 2004. He promised hope and change. And
you are what you are, folks. And right now you're a 6-5 football team. And guess what? That's just not good enough. It's not good enough for you. And it's certainly not going to be good enough for me. So if you think they hired me here to go 500, you got the wrong guy.
And maybe they do have the wrong guy, Ibrahim. Apparently
like
so.
They do. This is the main story in a college football team that's been otherwise lackluster. We know the top three teams. We know who's going to be vying for the bowl championship series. So all the direction has been focused on Charlie Weiss. The glare of the media is on his 35-26 record that he's had since he's been the head coach. The other person that was vying for that position that they wanted, their number one choice then, was a guy named Urban Meyer. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Urban Meyer, but he's now the coach of Florida. And then since that time, when he decided to take the job at Florida, he's won two national championships and two SEC titles. He's also 94-17 in that time period as well. So everyone, he's a devout Catholic, and everyone has said that he has said himself that the Notre Dame job would be his dream job.
So there you have it. This is preordained.
Well, in a sense, except that now he's actually not interested because he said he wants to stay at Florida as long as they'll have him because he's created a dynasty in Florida. Now, the other person that's interesting.
There's so many people go from Florida to South Bend in the winter, you know.
Exactly. And that's another. He's the third highest paid coach in college football as well. So
Notre Dame could top that. Don't you think they would?
Notre Dame could if they really wanted him to. Yeah. The other one is Brian Kelly, who's now the coach at Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. He's 32-6 while he's at Cincinnati. He's led Cincinnati to a top ranking in the Big East, and he actually has been mum. He said he's like he would be interested in talking about it. People in Cincinnati are scared about him leaving because he's created an amazing program. So that's where it stands right now. The story is Charlie Weiss is definitely going to get the hook. We'll see what happens against Samford this weekend, but we expect after the end of the game, he's going to lose his job.
The Weiss vigil continues. Karina Longworth in the studio, Takeaway movie contributor and freelance film critic. Good morning, Karina.
Good morning.
So, movies, big ritual for Thanksgiving weekend, and let's start right off with The Road. It's a small movie, but it could have a big impact. Here's a trailer.
That boy looks hungry. Why don't y'all come on the truck?
You look at him again, I'll shoot you in the head.
I don't think you killed a man in your life.
So, what do you make of The Road? It's in not wide release, but people will get a chance to see it this weekend.
Yeah, it'll be opening wider in the coming weeks. The Road is one of my favorite films of the year.
Really?
It's an adaptation of the Cormac McCarthy novel.
Viggo Mortensen.
Charlize Theron in a small role. And it's just, it's
this
really.
This kid is amazing.
Yeah, too. Yeah. It's just a really devastating, gorgeously shot film about how you maintain your humanity when you've lost everything else.
And it's based on the Cormac McCarthy book, which is about sort of the end of the world and what it's like after the end of the world. And if that is not something that you want to get involved in for Thanksgiving, although I have seen the movie and I say it's uplifting. I absolutely think that it's uplifting. It's great entertainment. You can go see Fantastic Mr. Fox, George Clooney, and that. What did you make of that?
That's another one of my favorite films of the year, and that is in wide release this weekend.
So this is a really good weekend for films.
Absolutely.
Robin Williams and John Travolta in a movie called Old Dogs. I've seen the billboards, haven't seen the movie.
Not so good.
Really, what's the problem?
Universally reviled. It's kind of a gross-out comedy about these two middle-aged guys who have to suddenly take care of children, but it's rated PG, so it can't really get that gross.
And Disney has an animated film coming out over the weekend, which should do well. They always do. Princess and the Frog. What do you think?
It's the first 2D animation film that Disney has put out in 5 years, so it's kind of a return to the old school. Oprah Winfrey is one of the voices, so that always helps. Generally, it's been well received.
And but your recommendations are
The Road and Fantastic Mr. Fox.
The Road and Fantastic Mr. Fox. Karina Longworth, Takeaway movie contributor and freelance film critic. Those are your takeouts.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, everyone, how a terror investigation into Al-Qaeda recruiting in Minneapolis is affecting the local Somali-American community. We're going to have more on that in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on top news stories right here at the bottom of the hour, 30 minutes past the hour, to be exact. The markets have just opened on Wall Street, and the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ are all moving ahead in early, expected to be light trading. New economic numbers just out this morning. Weekly claims for jobless benefits plunged to 466,000. That's the lowest level in more than a year. Consumer spending rebounded last month, rising a better-than-expected 0.7%. Our partner, the New York Times, says President Obama is signaling to allies that he will send as many as 25,000 to 30,000 additional troops to Afghanistan. Details will be rolled out on Tuesday when the president gives a primetime address. President Obama said the U.S. relationship with India will be a defining one in the 21st century. The president was speaking last night as he hosted the Indian Prime Minister at the White House.
To the future that beckons all of us, let us answer its call and let our two great nations realize all the triumphs and achievements that await us.
That was the president's toast. Among the more than 300 guests were Hollywood and Bollywood celebrities and a number of prominent Indian Americans.
The space shuttle and its seven astronauts have left the International Space Station. Atlantis undocked early this morning, ending a one-week visit. Heading home for the first time in 3 months, astronaut Nicole Stott bade farewell to the rest of the station crew.
Pleasure working with you guys. I was blessed with a wonderful crew, and I look forward to seeing you guys on the ground real soon.
Weather permitting, Atlantis is aiming for a Friday morning landing in Florida. Toyota will replace gas pedals on nearly 4 million recalled vehicles in the U.S. There's been a problem with sudden acceleration and the pedal becoming stuck on floor mats. Popular models like the Prius and Camry are part of the recall. As a temporary step, Toyota dealers will shorten the length of gas pedals beginning in January. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
So you heard the story earlier this week. The investigation into a Minnesota-based terrorism operation widened when federal authorities released criminal charges against 8 men connected to the operation. The group say prosecutors recruited young men to leave the United States and fight with terrorists for a group called Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Here is U.S. District Attorney Todd Jones speaking at the news conference yesterday.
A message that they should hear loud and clear is that we will seek you out and prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law.
Now, that message was certainly a national story this week, but it also resonated in the community of Minneapolis, where the Somali Americans are certainly the target of this investigation and have their own issues to deal with. Two voices now on this story. Reporter Tim Nelson is with us. He's been covering the case for Minnesota Public Radio. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
And we also have Mohammed Hassan, who's vice chair of Somali Cause, which is an umbrella organization for 9 grassroots groups in North America. And he actually knows some of the men who were indicted on Monday. Mohammed Hassan, good morning.
Morning to you, Tim.
Tim Nelson, first of all, how has this story been received in the Twin Cities area? And what is the sort of relationship like between the Somali American community and other residents of the Twin Cities?
Well, let me start with your first question.
Sure.
How this has been received. This is part of a year-long ongoing investigation that the Twin Cities news media has been tracking pretty carefully. This started, really came to light about a year ago when 3 young men disappeared and the Somali community really began to speak out loudly about their concerns about where they went. Since then, we've learned a lot about these young men that have left. We think there are about 20 of them. Probably 6 of them, most of them Somali immigrants, have been rumored to have been killed. But again, because there's no strong central government in Somalia, no real authority to issue death certificates, it's really unclear the fate of these young men. A lot of these names that came out this week, we've known for a long time. We've been reporting about them.
Right.
Some of them Minnesota Public Radio has actually talked to in Somalia. So this didn't come as a surprise. A lot of these folks we've been watching for some time. I think, though, that people feel like the federal authorities finally spoke out, finally had something to say about this, and we may be seeing the light at the end of the tunnel in this investigation. To your second question about the relationship between the Somali community and the rest of the Twin Cities. The last census said that there were about 35,000 Somali immigrants in the Twin Cities. There are probably many more than that now.
Right.
The Twin Cities has a history of bringing immigrant groups in, the Hmong from the
Southeast
date back
Asia.
From
yep.
the from the fighting the communists in Laos. They came in the 1970s and 80s and have been gradually assimilated into the culture here. A lot of the Somali immigrants began to come here after the overthrow of the government in 1990. It's estimated about 20,000 of them came about 10 years ago. They're a little different than other immigrants. They have some wider cultural differences, some religious differences, and it's been a difficult transition for them. They remain more isolated than other immigrant groups. And this isn't helping.
I can imagine.
The FBI agent in charge on Monday noted that, you know, there are now documented Americans with American passports training with Al-Shabaab, a terrorist organization in Somalia.
Well, that says it. Tim Nelson is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. Just hold on there for a second. Let's get a response from Mohammed Hassan, who's the vice chair of an umbrella organization for grassroots groups in North America representing Somali Americans. Mohammed Hassan, how does your community deal with, first, a story that's a tragedy because of the men who died, but also that might represent a threat to others who are neighbors in a community like the Twin Cities?
Well, speaking to the press conference that was held by FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, was received as though it was just showing that we were getting to some kind of end to this. It has been a very long investigation, as noted by Tim, and has taken really toll on the community, literally has put the community in siege. Thinking what is going to be the next step for the FBI, who is going to be arrested. And, of course, the community is not that huge of a number. You kind of notice your neighbors, whom are originally originally from Somalia. And so we kind of know each other, either growing together in the same neighborhood or played soccer together, or went in the same high school or college.
Well, so it's a tight-knit community. How do you deliver the message that this kind of behavior is threatening to all Somali Americans and discourage young people from doing these sorts of things?
There are a couple of public radios and televisions that Somalians do use to disseminate information to other Somali community members who speak only Somali. Also, individuals do read the news in English and listen to radios and television. But to communicate to authorities is the challenge. And
right.
It is because of the culture, I would think, and also the language barrier.
And
people are not willing to talk to authority. And also, given the fact that Somalians, the recent immigrated Somalians, have dealt in the past with authoritative authorities and somewhat has experienced corrupt police officers and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and they bring memories of those bad experiences in Somalia right to the United States for good reason. Mohammed Hassan, vice chair of Somali Cause. It's an umbrella organization for 9 grassroots groups representing Somali Americans in North America. Also, Tim Nelson joined us describing the difficulty of this story and how long it's been developing there in the Twin Cities. He's a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks to both of you. Coming up, our series on faith in America continues, and we'll talk with the nation's first special representative to Muslim communities. It's an office in the U.S. State Department. I'm John Hockenberry, here with Miles O'Brien, who's in for Celeste Headley. Coming up, our series on faith in America continues, Muslims and the first day of the Hajj. More on that in just a few moments. But first, a check of the news at just a little bit before 48 minutes past the hour.
All right. Twitter is growing fast in large part because of its ubiquitous nature, and it is free. And if that was a tweet, I'd already be done because that'd be more than 140 characters, I think. But free can't last. You can't make it up on volume. Twitter doesn't have advertisers or subscribers. So how's the newest dot-com phenom get in the black? The BBC's correspondent Mark Gregory has put the exact question to the co-founder of Twitter, a tweet himself. Mark Gregory, welcome to The Takeaway. Good to have you with us. What did BizStone have to say?
Well, I mean, he's a rather interesting man, and he's 34 years old, a multimillionaire already, and the man of the moment, a guy who's extremely popular. But as you mentioned in your introduction, the big issue facing Twitter now is how do you turn an internet phenomenon? This is something that earlier this year was believed to have about 10 million users. A couple of years' time, according to leaked memos from the company, not something they actually publicly talk about, they could have 1 billion people using Twitter. How do they turn that popularity into a sound business? Now, Biz Stone is essentially saying that because Twitter has become so popular that actually information about how people use it is of interest to business. So what they're going to do, he suggested, is that they're going to make a level of information available to businesses which goes beyond what's publicly available. So it won't be anything private about individuals, but ways that businesses can work out how Twitter's been used, what people are talking about, where they're talking about, that they can then, if you like, sell that greater level of access to businesses, and they'll pay good money for access to what could be possibly 1 billion people in a couple of years' time.
I guess the Iranian government would want to sign up for that program, huh?
I think they're going to bow out of that. What do you think? Yeah. As a matter of fact, we have a little bit of Biz Stone talking about this, and then we'll play off of that. Let's listen to Biz.
One very specific way is to capitalize on the use of Twitter by businesses and organizations as a sort of marketing and communications tool, is to provide some extra level of access that allows businesses to get more feedback about how they're doing on Twitter so they become a better Twitter user and therefore their followers are actually liking them better. That's something that we can charge for.
Well, Mark, there's one little problem. Some of the followers might not like that. It sort of smacks of sharing private information, doesn't it?
Well, that, I suppose, is one of the issues. It's the same debate about whether you put advertising on something like Twitter. If, as soon as you've got ads up there, people stop using it because they think of it as a pain. They use Twitter because it's simple and nobody's telling them what to do. So I suppose there is that fear that also selling information. On the other hand, the point that Twitter might make is that tweets are public things. You're letting your followers know things that you want them to know. So in a sense, you could argue that it's a bit different from perhaps Facebook, which, if you like, it's a closed network, people who know each other talking to each other largely, or indeed email, which of course is a totally private conversation. So with public information, and I think this is indeed is a point that Biz Stone made to me, that he sees Twitter as a bit more like Google, if you like. Like, it it's an information network rather than a social network, and therefore is perhaps easier to monetize in the long term. And as we all know, of course, Google made no money in its early years, despite the early popularity of its internet searches. But when they did work out a way of making money, they made a lot of money, and you now have a $125 billion company.
Thank you very much, Mark Gregory, BBC Business Correspondent.
John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien and for Celeste Headley. You hear about pilgrims every year when they talk about the first Thanksgiving, right?
It's a lot of myths.
Coming up, though, a very different set of pilgrims. On the first day of the Hajj, 2 million Muslims expected to be in Mecca. News just out, President Obama will attend next month's climate change summit in Copenhagen. In the headlines, the White House has just issued a statement, and U.S. troops around the world are preparing like everyone else for Thanksgiving. Earlier, we spoke with First Lieutenant Russell Galati, training with the Army in Germany, about his feelings about this holiday.
I'll miss my family and friends.
Lieutenant Galati said he doesn't want turkey with his rations. He prefers chicken, pasta, with pesto.
Nice.
All right, the order's in. And in sports, Roger Federer has reclaimed his spot at the top of the tennis world, securing the year-end number one ranking for the fifth time in his career. Record 15-time Grand Slam champion is now closing in on Pete Sampras's all-time mark of six. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
One nation under God, indivisible.
Specific divine being.
Religious discrimination.
Rediscovering God in America.
I truly do believe it's a miracle.
One nation under God.
Power of faith.
For most of you out there, the preparations are underway for Thanksgiving. And all this week, as we talk about faith in America, it's worth noting that Thanksgiving is a non-denominational holiday. People of all faiths prepare for the communal meal. But for American Muslims this year, Thanksgiving coincides with the beginning of the Hajj, the month of holy pilgrimage to the city of Mecca. All Muslims will be praying for the pilgrims this month, and thousands of Americans will be among the 2 million people who are gathering in Mecca today. Joining us now from our partner, the BBC, is Shazeb Jalani. He's on the ground in Mecca. Shazeb, good morning, and what does it look like on this first day of the Hajj?
Well, the streets of Mecca are bustling with pilgrims from all over the world. You can see them sleeping, praying, eating, shopping. And at first sight, you would think that this is probably one of the most busiest places.
And Shazeb Jalani, there are fluctuations in the number of pilgrims from year to year. What are the other things that affect the number of people who come to actually do the Hajj?
Well, many people think it's things like global recession, which affect people's decision. But I've been talking to a lot of pilgrims, and for Muslims, it's such a big deal. It's a journey of a lifetime that they've been saving for it for a while. I think this year, more than any year, it's the fear of swine flu, which has impacted people's decision. Internationally, I'm told that the crowd is more or less the same, but the local Saudi pilgrims, their numbers are much less this year than previous years. And we were talking to one of the senior officials at the Saudi Interior Ministry, and he admitted to us that they are expecting 40% decline in the number of Saudi pilgrims.
And as you say, the diversity of the Muslim world is reflected in the Hajj. You have people who bring a huge entourage and fly in their own planes, and then you have pilgrims who come with basically nothing but the clothes on their back. What do they expect over the next few days?
Well, over the last few days, pilgrims have been spending time at the sacred mosque. They've been praying and performing Umrah. Today, everybody is gathering in the tented city called Mina. Tomorrow, the pilgrims will be leaving for Arafat, which is an important milestone in these 5 days. They will be stoning the devil. And on Friday is the Eid al-Adha day, which is sort of the Muslim Christmas day. That's when they are supposed to sacrifice an animal. I mean, all these rituals are really aimed at remembering the sacrifices of Prophet Abraham and his wife. There's a social purpose to it. It is supposed to, as you said, be a symbol of solidarity, bringing in Muslims from all over the world, irrespective of their race, their language, their ethnicity, their class, their status. Everybody wears the white dress, which is sort of, you know, and they stand shoulder to shoulder throughout these rituals in very close proximity. community. So the whole idea is for Muslims to intermingle, to socialize, and develop a sense of belonging to one community.
Well, it's a great image there. Shahzeb Jalani, thanks so much for that picture. He's a BBC reporter on the ground in Mecca. From the 2 million faithful in Mecca to the more than a billion Muslims around the world, in a sense, reaching out to them is the responsibility of one very busy official at the U.S. State Department. Farah Pandith is our nation's first special representative to Muslim communities, and Celeste Headley and I sat down with her a few days ago. And in contrast to some of the other faith conversations we've had on The Takeaway this week, when politics and religion mix, the conversation can get a bit guarded. And certainly, Ms. Pandith conveyed to us that there are more than a few hotspots on her radar. We started with asking, why do we need a special representative to Muslim communities, but not one to, say, Buddhist, Catholic, or Hindu ones?
In this moment in time, it is very important that our country do everything that we can to offer an opportunity for dialogue on a wide set of issues that are taking place around the world that affect Muslim communities, both in Muslim-majority countries and Muslim-minority countries. And this engagement comes in many forms. And so right now, this is an important piece of what we're doing. And it's not to say that one community is more important than another, but we have to look at the way in which we've been working with communities on the ground and the needs that are out there right now. And right now we feel as though working on finding ways to build partnerships is very important.
I guess, Special Representative, I have a concern that you may have an uphill battle here, in the sense that I spent a fair amount of time in the Middle East. And, you know, the U.S. has a reputation for saying one thing up front, but doing a lot of things behind the scenes. And the CIA has a reputation for operating with the State Department as a front. USAID, a State Department organization, has had problems in the Muslim world. I would say that, you know, a lot of Muslims would think a special representative to Muslims is just another sign that the U.S. considers Muslim communities as having to be watched in some sense.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question that you raise, and I have a problem with the way in which you described it, because it doesn't. Let's talk about the diversity of Islam first of all. This engagement strategy is an engagement that's global. It is not just focused on one region of the world, either you know, the Middle East or another part of the world. It's an opportunity for us to get to know the next generation around the world, working on issues that aren't necessarily things that you would normally think about. When you think about ideas that young Muslims have in terms of building stronger communities, you think about their entrepreneurial spirit, their ideas to actually seed good things for the future of their communities.
And that happens all over the world. That happens all over the world.
Absolutely.
No, you make a fair point. What about Iran? What initiatives and partnerships are open to us in Iran in engaging with the Muslim communities, given the special circumstances post-election?
You know, I'm actually not going to be going to Iran, so I don't have an agenda set out for that country.
Okay, and what about some of the other hot spots? We just got a report out of Africa saying that a woman was stoned there by a radical Islamist who are going back to Sharia law. Is that part of your mission as well, to deal with those kind of issues?
We are seeing there are all sorts of things that are happening around the world, and you asked about challenging spots, and I think it's an interesting question, because there are issues that each community around the world are dealing with, whether or not you're talking about Muslims in Germany or you're talking about Muslims in Morocco, or you're talking about Muslims in any other part, in Indonesia, any other part of the world. There's not just certain buckets of things that are happening in various places.
Sure.
What we are trying to do, what we are endeavoring to do, is through our embassies to find ways to not just hit the hot crisis point issues, but to talk about things sort of that allow us to think more broadly and more creatively about engagement. And I think that's important. It's not just looking at Muslims as victims. It's giving respect to what's happening on the ground, to work with dignity and respect, and listening to what is taking place, and actually acting on some of the things that you're hearing on the ground that they want to build partnerships with. And I think that that's a new approach, and I think it's a very welcome one by many. If you only look at Muslim issues when there's a time of crisis, you're playing into a narrative that suggests that Muslims are victims, and that's not appropriate.
I was going to ask you about the Hajj, which recently began. Have you already made the Hajj in your life?
I haven't made the Hajj in my life, no.
And when are you planning to go?
That's a great question. I'm not sure when I'm planning to go. It's not this year, though.
Yeah, it's a busy year.
Well, I would imagine Farah Pandith, Special Representative to Muslim Communities in the State Department, I would imagine what you just said in this discussion we've had is as good an argument as any that we need a Special Representative to Muslim Communities around the world. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Farah Pandith is Special Representative to Muslim Communities in the U.S. State Department under Hillary Clinton. Celeste and I talked with her last week. Be sure to tune in tomorrow when we continue our Faith in America series with the 27-year-old pastor who heads the White House Office on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, Joshua Dubois. And tomorrow we're also opening up the lines of the Takeaway Turkey Hotline. That's right, to help you start your day in the kitchen. Need advice on the bird, how to make a better stuffing? Send us your questions. Send us your stories of turkey gone bad. Even the good news we're interested in tomorrow. The New York Times' Kim Severson and Julia Moskin will join us to answer your question. I mean, they're the experts. Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee. Have a happy Thanksgiving, John.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Thank you, Miles. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.